The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Mic check. All right. Thanks so much for having me here today. My name is Ouyun Kim. Just a big caveat, I'm not a developer. I'm not like, but I am, I'm a professor, so I look at a lot of data. I'm in like the data analytics side of stuff. So I thought this might be a really good opportunity to share with you some of my work and other people's work on what they've been doing to kind of measure the advances of free software and the implications of free software, right? So I hope this will be fun, but it's more like a call to arms. Like, you know, everybody should be out there collecting data, trying to see what the impact of free software is, and then testing those kinds of implications, right? So overall, this is gonna be the agenda. I'll start with some introduction and motivation. Tell you a bit about what the talk, the inception of this talk. The talk's largely divided into two parts, right? So the first part, I'll be talking about measuring free software, right? So one of the questions that I had a couple years ago when I was attending Libra Planet was, how well is free software doing, right? So how do we know if there's more free software, if there's less free software, is it advancing or is it like deteriorating, right? So I'm going to try to convince you that there has been some advancements over time, and I'm going to point you to some academic literature that has looked at, software, free software here. So once we've looked at how free software has changed over the past couple of years, I'm going to take a step forward and then try to show you some of the consequences of free software. So if you introduce free software, what happens downstream? Does it lead to more products? Does it lead to more innovation? Does it lead to more hacking and all of these things? So I have two case studies that I worked on for my dissertation. One of those regards OpenWRT. And a second component of this looks at the Linux kernel, right? And then I'll conclude, and then I'll have time for question and answers in case you have any. And at any point in time, just feel free to raise your hand and interrupt me if you have any questions or if you have any kinds of comments. I'm just going to repeat your question, and I'll answer it there and at that point in time, right? So, quick motivation. So my partner is a UX designer, right? So she looks at all of these like dashboards, like corporations really want to see like how their company is doing. And then one of the dashboards that she showed me looked something like this. Like, it shows you how profitable or how not profitable a certain segment is. What the projections are. Are we on target? Are we not on target? And I thought this might be like a good opening slide to this talk, because I was hoping we'd have something like this for free software, right? Is there more, are there more software using GPL licenses or are there less? How much development is there going on in these particular free software projects as opposed to non-free or proprietary software projects, right? So in my mind, this is what I want to create ultimately. I have not created this, and I'm not gonna get very close to creating this, but I'll show you kind of what the past couple of years have been like so that we have a starting point to kind of, start creating some of these things, right? So, and I'm sorry this you know, I tried a sneaky thing where I tried to hide the bullet points with like white bars, but then it obviously broke. But I have two questions today, right? So the first question was, how do you measure free software in the first place, right? So we always talk about free software, freedom, you know, the four freedoms, but then how is exactly do you measure the extent of free software, or how do you measure like the use of free software? That's the first question. And then the second question is, how do you measure the impacts of free software, right? So not just free software itself, but how does it get used? Does it get distributed more often and so forth? And so to summarize what the next 45 minutes are going to be about, for the first question, right, so how do you measure free software? I'm going to take a stab at this, and I'm going to show you how software license usage has changed over time. So we know that there's a bunch of different licenses. Some are free, some are not free, and we're going to see how those, you know, license adoptions changed over time. So there's some academic literature that looks at licensing schemes and how, you know, projects decide to change or not change licenses. The second question, which is the downstream kind of impacts of free software, I'm going to take a look at this using my own work. The first one is going to be in product markets, and to give you a preview, I look at OpenWRT and how that impacted kind of the reviews on Amazon for the routers that are compatible with OpenWRT, and I'm going to share with you some of that. And the second one is about follow-on innovations, right? So I think one of the things that free software promises, or, you know, is that anybody can open up the code, they can modify it, they can distribute it freely. Does it actually lead to more modifications, and does it actually lead to more kind of distributions? I don't have a complete answer for this, but at least within the Linux kernel, I'm going to be able to show you some interesting patterns regarding this. So, some big caveats. I'm not an engineer by training, so I'll make a ton of mistakes. I'm not a lawyer by training either, so I'll make, again, a ton of mistakes. And I definitely will have missed many important papers or topics. So if there's anything obvious that you know about that I haven't covered, just feel free to let me know, raise your hand, and then talk about this. All of these errors are my own. But if you do want to reach out or add anything, just reach out to me. This is my email address if you see anything that's interesting. So moving on to the first topic, right? So measuring free software. Again, this is a couple years back. I was in LibrePlanet, and then I was thinking about, like, how do you know free software is doing great or not great? And then to kind of understand this, we, in principle, have to go back to the four freedoms, right? So, and this is kind of an abridged version of, you know, freedom to run the program, freedom to study and redistribute and distribute your modified copies. Is there a way to test these four freedoms, right? So we know that if you have access to the source code and then you can download it and modify it, then we have some starting points. But as far as I understand, there's no, like, automated way to test whether a given piece of software follows these four freedoms, right? So, and I think that's like a call for arms again. Like, if you know of a way that you can kind of, you know, automatically test whether a given piece of software obeys these four freedoms, I think that would be a really cool thing to add. But in the absence of this software, which I'm not aware of, what I'll be looking at are these free software licenses, and, you know, the Free Software Foundation maintains a list of these licenses on their website. And, you know, this is really cool for those of you who are just in the previous talk. The previous talk was also about the history of these different licenses. So very briefly, I'll just go over these licenses. So in the 60s, as we all know, it's all commonplace sharing of code was happening. And then starting in the 1980s was when we start seeing more of these copyleft licenses, right? So the Free Software Foundation and the GPL emerged in like 1983. Most of this was kind of in response to, of course, Richard Stallman's, you know, experience with his printers, but also AT&T's litigation against Unix. And then afterwards, in the 1990s, we've seen a lot of different free software licenses that have emerged. So how have these different licenses been used? I'll take you back in time to near the early 2000s, right? So if you think back to when it was the 2000s, GitHub wasn't there, Git wasn't there either. SourceForge had just started in 1999. So that was the main kind of repository. And before SourceForge, it was probably Usenet. You know, I wasn't around for that time. But so to my kind of understanding, SourceForge is one of the earliest snapshots of, you know, free software that we can get. Josh Lerner and Jean Tirole looked at SourceForge back in 2002 or 2005. So they downloaded SourceForge. Their data set had 38,000 projects, and keep that number in mind because it'll get like exponentially larger very soon. But they collected the licenses for 38,000 projects in May of 2002. They matched this with the commit data as well as like the usage data, so downloads and stuff like that. What they found at that point in time was that at least within their data set, 82% of the code was licensed under GPL or LGPL. And there was 7% BSD, and then the rest were kind of like, you know, random different licenses. They also highlighted two different distinctions between licenses, which will get repeated, you know, continuously. They call one set of licenses highly restrictive licenses, and the GPL falls under it. It's restrictive because it puts more restrictions on, like, you know, your copies need to be get more copies and so forth. And then they look at less restrictive licenses and so forth. And they look at the pattern between who chooses these restrictive GPL-type licenses versus the non-GPL licenses, and then they find that, oh, it's mostly end users and sysadmins and, you know, that are using these restrictive licenses, but developers and commercial projects and, you know, companies would use these less restrictive licenses, right? And this is just a table, and I'm sorry, this is really, really hard to see, but this is a table from their paper back in 2005 and 2002, but you'll see the vast majority of software, you know, free software was licensed under GPL. So what happened after that? So there's a couple of papers that look at changes between 2002 and 2013. And again, this is from work by Christian Vendome. He's over in the College of William and Mary, I believe. But now, you know, he has the benefit of hindsight. So now it's 2015. He has access to GitHub and like a much larger repository database, right? So what he does is he goes and collects data from GitHub, and he's specifically looking at Java projects, right? So now he has 380,000 repositories that he can crawl from, right? So, you know, 10 times the order of magnitude. And then what does he do? He does a commit by commit analysis of the licenses using this software called Marcos. Right? So what he does is he reverts to a commit, and then he looks at the licensing at that point in time, and then he tracks each project over time to see if the projects change their licensing at any given point in time. And what he's going to try to do is he's going to try to link that to discussions within the community about whether or not we should change the license, if we do change the license, what is it for, and so forth. You know, to briefly summarize, he finds that, you know, free software generally is moving towards less restrictive licenses, so away from the GPL and more to like Apache MIT type licenses. But it's very, very difficult to pinpoint exactly why, you know, these projects change licenses. And this is a graph that I wish I had, you know, I could make bigger, but it really shows you this huge increase in the adoption of Apache licenses and so forth, right? So the left side of this graph is 2002, and on the right side is 2013 or 2012, I believe. So over on the top, you'll see these GPL-type licenses. And initially, it went from about 50% of all of the repositories that he looked at to around maybe 30%, 35% or so. But then in the meanwhile, you see this huge growth in Apache-type licenses. And again, keep in mind that there's a lot of new repositories that are being created over this time. So it seems, or at least in my mind, it seems that these new software projects are adopting Apache-type licenses and so forth. And, you know, and this is essentially the same kind of graph that you can, you know, that you'll have an even more difficult time seeing. what else happened after 2012 or 2013? I found this interesting paper. It's not peer-reviewed like the other stuff in this talk, but it's from this person's dissertation, right? So he was looking at was this change in GitHub in 2013. So in 2013, what GitHub did is they introduced a license picker. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but when you go onto GitHub and then you're starting your own repository, it allows you to choose some sort of license, and it has a drop-down menu, and then it'll automatically add these license files to your repository, right? So what Sinha is going to do is they're going to analyze the repositories right before and right after this change. And again, they have, you know, it's 2021 now, so now they have 33 million repositories. So they're just looking at all of GitHub. And what they find is that there's very prevalent no license projects on, you know, online. And note that no license is not free software, right? So you can have like MIT license and it'll be still considered free software according to the Free Software Foundation's definitions. But then if you don't have any license, it's not free software, right? But what he also finds, and he doesn't give any percentages for these, is now you see the MIT license being the predominant kind of license choice, followed by Apache, ISC, BSD, and then GPL 3 and so forth, right? And so these are some interesting graphs from his paper. So on the figure on the left-hand side shows you the percentage of repositories with licenses, right? So it initially starts being very well licensed, and then over time it kind of drops because people are just creating these repositories, they're not really licensing it out. And once GitHub introduces this tool to choose your licenses, they see a very immediate increase in people's choice of licenses. Where do those licenses go to? Interestingly, it seems that GPL, increased the most, at least according to the HITS analysis. The MIT and Apache also increase following this choice, right? And finally, I don't know if Zach is here or in the IRC, but there's been some more expanded repositories now. So it's not just GitHub, but now you have the Software Heritage Foundation and all of these other free software repositories, right? So what Stefano Zaccarelli does is he collects all of the Software Heritage Archive data, and now he has 6 million unique license files. So he has all of the repositories. He's going to take all of the licenses and then he's going to deduplicate all of these. And he ends up with 6.5 million unique licenses. And from there, he finds that those unique licenses, about 40% are MIT, which is understandable because in the MIT license, you need to include yourself, and that introduces like a slight variation. So that's why you see a lot of different MIT licenses here. And he says that this isn't a reason to believe that the MIT license is the most popular license, but it seems like MIT is pretty popular according to this other study by Santiago et al. And they also use GitHub data, 7 million repositories, and they find that in that data set, about 57% are using MIT licenses, 15% Apache, and 14% are GPL 3 or so. And just visually, this is what it looks like in Zach's paper. And as I said, MIT is popular. And he says that, in the paper, he says it would be a trivial task to kind of link these unique license hashes to the actual projects that they were used in. I wanted to do that, but then I kind of ran out of time, so I wasn't able to do this. But then it would be really cool to see if you can match these unique licenses. So now you have identifiers for whether the license is an MIT-type license or a GPL-type license, and then follow it over time as well. So overall, there's some mixed evidence as to whether, in terms of the license choice, but we do see that free software seems to be growing, right? So there's more and more repositories that are using these free software licenses, but the popularity of those licenses have been changing over time. right? So there's been a very significant growth in MIT type and Apache type licenses, and you know, relatively less gains in the GPL type licenses. But as I said before, these licenses are only just a snapshot of what kinds of freedoms are offered by the repositories, and it'd be really cool if somebody could go and test whether the four freedoms are upheld, right? So we've seen how software repositories have changed since the early 2000s and up until the 2020s, and that's just the change in the software itself. What I'm really interested in as a researcher is how do those impact our daily lives, right? So do they lead to more innovations? Do they lead to more products? Do they lead to more entrepreneurship? I have a bunch of questions later that I would like to ask you, and if you know any stories of how open source, free and open, excuse me if I say open source, because it's just, at other conferences I have to say open source, obviously. But anyways, if you know any stories of how free software has impacted, like for instance, entrepreneurship, follow-on innovation, or some sort of scientific discoveries, I'd be really, really interested to listen to those too. And while, and what does the academic literature have to say about the implications of having more free software? Generally, it's gonna be positive, it's gonna be better than not having free software for sure, right? But it seems that companies, for instance, some of the really interesting points from the literature, I think, are that because of free software and the availability of such free software, GDP is going to be mismeasured, right? So you're going to not capture all of the benefits that these free software projects are providing, and that's not going to be accounted in the GDP. And according to work by Greenstein and Nagel, they find that it's about several trillion dollars worth of GDP not being captured by these budget measures. But also, what's in it for firms? And I think this is like some really interesting, talking points that you could give to your friends or other people in corporations. What's in it for us, for the corporations? Like, why should we contribute to free software? There's other work that shows that if you use free software in your own work, it'll increase your productivity. And if you contribute to free software, then your productivity gains will be doubled by your contribution, because you learn from the process of contributing, and it's a really good place to start, I think. So again, to measure like these impact of free software projects, you generally can't just rely on the source code itself, and then you'll need to match it to other kinds of data sources. Which is what I try to do with OpenWRT. So this is part of my work on my dissertation. But essentially, I was asking, how does free software impact product market sales, right? So if you have free software, does it increase sales? Does it decrease sales? What else does it do? I hypothesized, and this will sound very familiar to you, but who values free software? It's the people that like tinkering with free software, right? So if suddenly some router product becomes compatible with OpenWRT, and now you can install OpenWRT either because like some sort of drivers came up, then it'll attract those technical people. They'll leave marvelous reviews, and then that'll attract even more people and purchase those kinds of devices. So for those of you who don't know about OpenWRT and then how it started, there's a long time ago, Linksys released this router called the WRT54G. It was created by this Taiwanese company called CyberTan, who, when they were creating this model, they installed Linux into the hardware without Linksys really knowing. Right, so Broadcom had provided CyberTan with like Linux drivers and Linux operating system to develop with. CyberTan just installed that and then sent it off to Linksys. And then Linksys, later people found out that, before this. So Cisco acquires Linksys in 2003, and now Cisco has is they have a device that has Linux installed on it. They don't know that it has Linux installed on it. They haven't released the source code and so forth. And long story short, the FSF stepped in, and then now Cisco has to release all of the software, and that's how OpenWRT got started, right? And so what I'm going to do is I went on Wikidevi, which is no longer, but now, you know, back then it was there, and I went on to OpenWRT. So both of these websites contain all of the price, all of the products that are compatible with OpenWRT, and in addition, you have you know, hardware information that's provided by Wikidevi, and then I'm matching that to Amazon, right? So for each of the routers that are in Wikidevi and that you, and sorry, this is again like so messed up, but essentially I have this data set of routers that and hardware characteristics and whether it can run OpenWRT or not, and the exact point in time which OpenWRT became compatible, right? And then I'm going to link that to reviews and review ratings and review text and so forth. The final data set consists of 1,000 products or so and 180,000 reviews with, you know, equally many reviewers. So what happens is I think I find that once your router can run OpenWRT, the review ratings go up, right? So what's happening is it's attracting a lot of technical people. They leave reviews like this, right? So they would say, oh, this Linksys router, I've had it for 15 years. I still love it to this day. It can run OpenWRT, and I'm going to buy like 10 more in, you know, 5 years. So those kinds of reviews really, really increase the ratings and for long periods of time. The time scale on this graph, so this graph, what it's showing you is the change in ratings before and after a product can run OpenWRT. Right, so before it's kind of like centered around zero, but then afterwards, if you squint harder, it's you know, it increases by about 0.4 stars, right? And what's interesting was that those the users that are leaving reviews for these routers, those reviews tend to be tagged as more helpful. And what I interpreted this to be is, you know, they're helping out other people make purchasing decisions, right? And it's going to increase the sales of routers. So on the one hand, you see the impact of free software. It can actually, once you have more free software, it can lead to increases in ratings. It can lead to more sales of a particular product. How about innovation? And I'm going to add a, this is going to be a, you know, I'm not going to answer my question exactly about whether it leads to more follow-on innovation, but so this second study is about follow-on innovation, right? So can individual developers or free software lead to more follow-on code? And the parallel that I was thinking about here was if you have two identical software products, one is free software and the other is proprietary, are the development paths of those two going to look different? Is one going to lead to more follow-on innovation and less follow-on innovation and so forth? The particular version of this that I'm going to be looking at is within the Linux kernel, I'm going to be looking at corporate, initially committed by corporations, you know, files that are initially committed by corporations and files that aren't, you know, committed by corporations, right? And the reason that I'm looking at this is because corporations are more interested in this last stage of innovation. So they're most incentivized to contribute wherever there's some sort of commercialization opportunity, as opposed to non-corporations who don't really care about these commercialization opportunities, right? So So this was a while back. I collected the commit history of the Linux kernel. So just a simple git log command, you know, author emails, hashes, committer names and dates. I run diffs on all of those commits so that you get the list of files, the number of insertions, deletions that happen to those files, as well as, you know, commit messages and so forth, right? So what that gives me is I can track particular files over time. I can track how many lines were inserted, how many lines were deleted, and by whom it was inserted or deleted. And so now you can kind of see that, you know, if I can match these email addresses to corporations or non-corporations, then I can see whether corporations are, you know, contributing much more or much less. I'm going to use some non-free software here. I'm going to use this tool called SciTools Understand. So what that does is it does these dependency matrix kind of analysis, right? So it will look at your header files and then see how many times that header file is being used in other parts of the kernel and so forth, right? Basic idea is that if a header is, used by many different parts of the kernel, then it'll be like a more useful tool than like a device driver that only is used once. And in addition to those dependency matrices, I'm looking at comment to code ratio. I'm also looking at cyclomatic complexity and nesting complexity and all of these things, right? And I already talked about this a bit, but dependency structures are just how, I think these are compile time dependencies. So when you compile this, does this get included? And again, if I'm making any mistakes, just feel free to completely, destroy me or whatever. But anyways, these are the kinds of variables that I am looking at. And, I manually go through most of the email domains and I match them to corporations by typing in that email address into a browser and then seeing if that is a company, if it's like a licensed place or not. So that's how I determine whether a particular email address is like a corporate address or a non-corporate address. And just, for the sake of like being clear about the data, this is going to underestimate the extent of corporate participation because, corporate contributors can use their Gmail addresses. It won't get caught by these kinds of things. And again, this is super hard to see, but I thought these summary statistics were interesting, so I'll just leave them on here for a second. So I'm going to compare files that are created by corporations and files that aren't created by corporations. And these are files created in 2008 to 2010 within the kernel, within the Linux kernel. If you compare the total number of commits, the corporate created files get slightly more commits. So on average, it'll get 240 as opposed to like non-corporate, which gets 200. Similar story for insertions and deletions. But I wanted to look at this, the dependency graphs that I talked about earlier, right? So do corporate created files get used elsewhere in the kernel or not? And if you look at these numbers, generally corporate contributed files are used by 15-ish other files on the kernel as opposed to 23 for the non-corporate committed files, right? So you can see that there's individual developers that are contributing source code that's going to be more useful and lead to more follow-on innovation elsewhere. And it's interesting because the comment to code ratio is slightly higher for the corporations than it is for non-corporate files. And the corporate contributed code also happens to have higher cyclomatic complexity, so it's written in ways that are that are more complex in terms of like computationally. So in the end, what I think I'm trying to show is that there's a lot of potential for free software to lead to new follow-on innovations, right? It's not really constrained by corporate monetization incentives, so they don't really need to. Corporations need to meet a bottom line like in the next couple of years, but the benefit of free software is that it'll lead to a lot more people don't need to think about whether this is going to be profitable in a year or two, and then they'll continue to contribute. But so those are some of the ways that I think that free software has impacted downstream. Some other interesting ideas, again, and I mentioned this earlier, is would there be an actual test of the four freedoms? Like, is there some sort of software that will tell you whether a code is freedom preserving or if it's not? Second question that I thought would be interesting is, are development patterns of proprietary and free software going to be different? Is proprietary software going to not lead to more follow-on innovation? And finally, I think this is motivated by the fact that GDP is not going to account for free software. How do you measure the value of free software, like in terms of monetary value? And I think all of these questions, you know, answering these questions will make it a lot easier to convince other people, corporations, non-corporations, to you know, create more free software code and contribute to the community. But that's kind of all that I had for today. And if you have any questions and if you have any suggestions, feel free to ask them or, you know, ask them now or later in person. And these are some of the references that I had for the talk. So thanks so much. Or if you have any stories.
Thank you for a talk. This was then basically was quite focused on the development, let's say, of a Linux kernel. Is there also research like in the usage of this? Like, do you have, is there research going on? How often, like, is the Linux kernel compiled and distributed with the Linux, GNU Linux distribution or applied with companies? Is there also something like this? I mean, the one thing is you have all those people coding, but is this contributing to more application of this source code then?
I see. So I know that there's some work, not particularly on Linux, but then with the Apache servers. So one of the papers that I mentioned in the talk pinged all of these public server IPs and then retrieved whether the server's running Apache or some other different form of server. And that's how they arrive at this, of this mismeasurement of GDP and so forth. But I don't think that there's much research on, you know, how many times the Linux kernel was compiled and so forth, but I think those are, you know, if there's some sort of way to measure that, I think that would be really interesting. And, you know, in a previous talk, I know web browsers measure, like, what kinds of, you know, browser and what kind of operating system you're running. And through that, you can kind of get the sense that Linux is kind of popular on, you know, mobile devices and less so in personal computers. But that would be really interesting to see. Yeah.
There's a good body of literature out there. Do you have any sense from what you've seen or heard how much of this is being taken seriously in boardrooms or in any other environment that is decision-making power?
You know, I wish I knew, but I'm not in those boardrooms. So, but that being said, I think in terms of like when, you know, governments, I think that there's, you know, this literature has gotten the attention of governmental bodies, and there have been, you know, for instance, in the EU, there's been pushes to support open, you know, open and free software, and but there's a lot of popular press articles about whether companies should release some of their code as, you know, open or whatever license free software. I don't know if anybody has studied like the extent to which corporations have made those decisions and, you know, how large those, but, you know, just in, coming from, I feel like just my feeling is that there's been a lot of new software that corporations have released underneath these free software licenses that have attracted a lot of development. But I do know, or at least I think I learned that a lot of those contributions within those corporations is just by those corporations themselves, and it's not really attracting a lot of like community development, I think. But yeah.
I guess if, I can go for another one. The when you're looking at the different licenses that are out there, there's the proprietary program, Black Duck, that tries to do a lot of this licensing thing. Do you know about how they're doing that, or is that something that has shed any light on how to roll up information pertaining to licenses that are linked to software packages?
No, I haven't. No, I don't think I've heard, or at least I'm not really aware of how they do this, but I'd love to you know, get your sense on
that.
Yeah,
I don't know how they do it. I just know that they do it, and a lot of people pay them a lot of money to do it. So,
I know there's like a lot of like CS literature that tries to take and automatically detect licensing incompliant, you know, like if you're trying to merge two projects, will that lead to some sort of licensing troubles? But I think, you know, that's as far as I'm aware of, and I don't know about Black Dog. Yeah.
There's a question from IRC by Toon. Do you consider skew to lax licenses is the way that was presented in chooser dialogue and in GitHub biased description of licenses?
Again, I'm not an engineer, so I might have missed. Can you read the question again? Or skew to license?
Yeah, or if you're in the IRC, rephrase that. But skew. Do you consider skew to lax licenses in the way it was presented in the chooser dialogue and in the GitHub a biased description of license?
Oh, I see. Like, oh, in the GitHub. I think it did. It didn't really mention that. I'm not the author on that study, so I haven't really dealt with the data myself, but I remember back in 2013 when I was starting like a couple of GitHub repositories that just defaulted, I think, to MIT licenses sometimes, and or I defaulted to MIT licenses because that was before I knew about these different licenses and so forth. So I'm sure that there's some sort of biasing happening there too, but it'd be really hard to tell.
Hi, thanks for the talk.
No,
I had a few thoughts. The Linux kernel development, corporate versus non-corporate, did you take into account the effects of like driver code versus not driver code?
Yes, so I did look at architecture like dependent versus, you know, and you know, you might expect that corporations are contributing to the drivers and not necessarily like, you know, schedulers or something like that. And I think that's mostly true. But I was surprised, I think, at how much they're also contributing to non-driver stuff. So it's non-zero. They're contributing to those parts of the kernel, and community members seem to be developing drivers as well. So there's still some, you know, symbiosis going on there too. But that's an interesting like variable, I think.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I think two other interesting things. I don't have much to say about them, but it might be interesting to look at like traditionally more free software friendly companies versus not, like Red Hat and Canonical versus like Microsoft.
Right.
And it might be interesting to look at stuff that is out of tree, like OpenZFS or Lustre, for example, are two file systems that are out of tree, and they probably have different development patterns than something that's been upstreamed.
Oh, that's a really interesting idea. Okay, I'll have to take a look into those.
And there's another thought about the earlier part of your presentation, the GitHub repositories. Have you looked at, or I know you probably didn't author those papers, but useful repositories versus maybe not useful ones. So like ones that have active development, active usage. An example that came to mind is like, if you look at free operating system kernels, the majority of them are probably under lax licenses, like BSDs, MITs, but Linux, GLP2, probably has a few orders of magnitude more usage in active development.
I think, when I was doing the literature review for this, there's, you know, Linux kind of dominates the activity on, you know, on those open source like repositories, and because they're GPL2, GPL2 takes up a significant chunk, I think. You know, but even if you reduce the number of repositories to the ones that are active and have more than one contributor, I think 70% of all repositories on GitHub have just one contributor. So if you reduce it to just those samples, I think it's pretty much a similar kind of story in which you have significant parts that are licensed under the GPL, but then you see this increase in MIT and Apache type licenses too.
Okay. One other thing I just thought of, it might be interesting to look at license distributions on different GNU Linux distributions. So like Red Hat versus Ubuntu versus mm-hmm. corporate distros like AL2 or right. whatever one Microsoft does. Mm-hmm. Could be interesting.
Okay.
But yeah, thanks.
All right, thank you.
So there is a couple things you were doing in your literature review. I think it was Frank Nagel was mm-hmm. talking about productivity differences between developers that participate in open source projects and those that don't. I know that that's somebody else, but could you give kind of just a quick summary of what that literature is, if that's...
Sure. Okay. So I think what he does, and you know, I talked with him when he was working on this, but so he has all these publicly traded companies. So for those companies, you have their financial statements, right? So you have the cost of operating and you know how much revenue they're generating. And what you can do with that data is you can translate that into like a productivity model. So based on the human capital and then like the raw materials that you input into the corporation, how much are they getting out of this? It's essentially what he's measuring. And he's taking companies that use any type of open source, and you know, this is there's a Hartanks data, so it's a set data set that you know contains information about companies and whether they have some sort of free or open source system, either it be like operating systems, it could be a server, it could be their voice over IP kind of system or whatever. If a company uses those you know, software, they have a higher productivity factor than the companies that don't. And even if you compare, you know, two very similar companies, one uses free and open source, another doesn't, it still persists. And now he's going to link that to this question. I think it's a questionnaire-based thing. So the companies answer whether or not they contribute to open and free software. And I think those companies have a even greater gain in productivity from using the free and open source software. Yeah, so it was a super interesting paper, I think. Yeah.
Hi there. So you were thinking about tests, automated tests for checking for the four freedoms, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure about what you could do with code analysis directly, but I was wondering about sentiment analysis on web forums mm-hmm. and or communities. So for instance, I just bought a Mycroft Mark IV. So the Mycroft is the open AI assistant. Mm-hmm. And the company is basically going under right now, mm-hmm. largely because of a patent troll, but also because they totally broke compatibility with their entire established community plugin system mm-hmm. and then failed to teach anybody how to write new plugins for it, hoping that they could angle in on a business market.
Right.
And if you were to just pull data from their web forums and just run a basic like sentiment analysis, you could see how angry everyone was and mm-hmm. the frustration. Why is no one communicating with us, right? Mm-hmm. And so insofar as open source software is more than just a license, which seems to be what you were pointing at. It's a community. It's the ability to actually understand what it is, how to read the code, and support available.
Right.
That seems like a different angle for
analysis. Yeah, no, for sure. And I, so if there's like a, so right now I think a lot of these analyses rely on the fact that there's centralized repositories for source code. Mm-hmm. If there's a centralized repository for all of the conversations, that would be really, really cool to do like some sort of sentiment analysis on. And see if they're becoming more, you know, open or less like restrict or you know whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. Maybe I can convince Zach to create after his software heritage, he can create like the community heritage thing, and then you can have all of these conversations like the Linux kernel mailing list or mm-hmm. other things all into one repository. But I think that's where the next kind of step would be mm-hmm. for sure.
Cool.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
One more question, last question from IRC Tunes asks, do you know any other research or that studied project growth or decline after the project changed license to more lax or copyleft?
I'm not aware of anything that does that analysis. All of the papers that I've seen up until now have been just whether the license changed or not, but not really the consequences of, you know, post-change, were there any changes to the repository. But I feel like that would be an interesting question to ask. And maybe I'll work on that too.
Thank you very much, Joe Yun.
Thank you.